Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's a recent phenomenon, one that only became legal 8 years ago in 2018. But in that time, it has grown rapaciously and threatens to change the nature of the very institutions it thrives on. I'm talking about sports gambling. It is a runaway success. Americans now wager about $150 billion each year through legal sports gambling. That number was $120 billion just 3 years ago. It's being driven by the fact that 39 states have legalized it, by the plethora of betting apps like FanDuel, DraftKings, and BetMGM, by the legion of fans who support the NFL and its Super Bowl, along with events like March Madness, and quite frankly, almost any sport or sporting event or athlete or play or any moment in any game at any time, you get the picture. In fact, sports gambling may be transforming a nation of sports fans into one of sports bettors, and that may be changing the reason for which we are attracted to sports in the first place. The rise, the risks and rewards, and the consequences of sports gambling are the subject of a just-released book by local journalist Danny Funt. Funt has written for The Washington Post, The New Yorker, The Wall Street Journal, and the Columbia Journalism Review, among other publications, and his book's title should give anyone who participates regularly in this relatively new phenomenon pause. It's called Everybody Loses: The Tumultuous Rise of American Sports Gambling. And Danny Funt joins us for the hour. Morning. Welcome.
Good morning, sir. Thanks for having me.
Very welcome. Nice to have you with us. I made a joke when you walked in the room that you must be related to Alan Funt of Candid Camera, and by gosh, you are.
That's right. Proud to be the grandson of the creator of Candid Camera and the son of the man who took over for Alan Funt, Peter Funt, my dad. Yeah, it's a wonderful legacy.
So we're not being punked this morning. You're actually here in the studio, right?
Well, we would never use that word for one. No, not a Candid Camera gag that I know of, but yeah.
Okay. Well, let's start with the title of your book, Everybody Loses. All gambling efforts are set up so the house wins, or at least the majority of the time the house wins. So is that what you're talking about, or is this much broader than that?
Quite a bit broader, yeah. You know, this was the title came to me after speaking with hundreds of people in all different roles around sports betting, whether that's people who work at the gambling operators, athletes, health experts, researchers, and certainly gamblers of all stripes. And the realization for me was that, yes, we're losing a staggering amount of money as we bet at the rate you just described, but it's so much more than money. Leagues losing trust in the integrity of their games now that there's such a grave threat of fixing, much worse than, you know, in the Black Sox days, the opportunities to corrupt sports with gambling are massive. Sports media losing their independence as they are taking so much money from gambling advertisers and as a result maybe biting their tongue if there's something unflattering worth reporting about the betting industry. And certainly when we talk about public health, the loss there is potentially dire, seeing addiction rates surging, young people suddenly consumed by gambling, which is very dangerous. All of that is just an overwhelming amount of losing. And then the follow-up question might be, and who's winning? And I find that's a little bit harder to answer.
Well, I guess the sports apps, the betting apps are winning, right?
Even that's not quite so simple. Oh. You know, after the Supreme Court ruled in 2018 that a federal ban on bookmaking outside of Nevada was invalid and all these states rushed to legalize, you had about 60 companies flood the marketplace and think, hey, as you said, the house always wins. This is a slam dunk business. Many of them have folded or pulled back from certain states. It's very expensive to operate a sports book. And even more importantly, people are finding that you don't really need 10 sports gambling apps, right? Like it's largely a commodity product. The odds are generally the same. The user experience is the same. So FanDuel and DraftKings in particular have been so successful at becoming household names, showering customers with these very generous promotions to keep them betting. You and I drive by FanDuel and DraftKings ads, you know, everywhere we go. And for a lot of other operators, they just can't, they can't tread water. So even for them, they're not winning.
I said in the beginning, and I think this figure either came from you or some research that I did, but we wager now about $150 billion a year through these sports gambling platforms. And that number is growing. That number could be outdated already. It may be well in advance of $150 billion. So if we're putting that kind of money into it, what are the winnings like? Do we have any figures on how much they're paying out?
Sure. And let me just note that that's $150 billion wagered legally.
All right, right.
One of the arguments for legalization was that it would drive out this black market of street bookies and offshore websites taking Americans' bets illegally. That hasn't happened. The black market continues to thrive. By some estimates, maybe $50 billion are wagered illegally.
Why?
Still. They kind of have an inherent draw for some people. You know, you can bet on credit. You can bet anonymously. If you don't want a gambling app in your bank statement, that's appealing to some people. There are things you can bet on through the black market that you can't bet on through regulated operators. The list goes on, but yeah, they'll also take bets from certain people that regulated sportsbooks don't want their business, and we can get into what that's all about. But yeah, the bottom line is the black market continues to exist, and when you said, you know, who's actually getting paid out, it's brutally difficult to make money betting on sports. So if we're betting $150 billion legally, the operator is holding on to roughly $15 billion in revenue. And that margin might not sound like a lot. It's actually a lot higher than this business used to run on. It used to be a very narrow margin business. Mm-hmm. They'd hold something like $5 for every 100 wagered. A part of that was this was happening in casinos, and they said, let's have people come for sports betting, then hopefully they mosey over to the craps tables and the slot machines where we really make money. But yeah, $15 billion year after year for this business.
I said at the beginning, and I think these are your words of warning, that this nation may be turning from a nation of sports fans to a nation of sports bettors. People are betting on everything surrounding sports, not just the outcomes of these games. And we can talk about the little things that they bet on, whether the guy's going to throw a certain pitch at a certain point in the game or not, and then you win or lose based on whether they do that. Is betting eventually going to eclipse sports, and what are the ramifications of that?
Yeah, that could well be. And I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I do think it's useful sometimes to return to the arguments for legalization and, and test, has that really proven true? One of the arguments was, there's so many people betting illegally already. All this is going to do is convert them into legal customers so that we can tax and regulate that betting activity. It's not going to grow the number of people betting. That might sound ludicrous on its face. It's definitely not what we're seeing. So many people who never would have dreamed of dealing with a shady bookie, street bookie, or sketchy offshore website are now bombarded right. with ads and saying, this looks like harmless fun.
So is betting itself a sport now?
It's definitely the main reason a lot of people tune in. There's something about the idea that you can use your knowledge of sports to outsmart the bookmaker that's so seductive. And people don't realize that the odds are just as difficult to overcome as at a blackjack table or a roulette wheel. The house advantage, coupled with the fact that if everyone across the world is around the world is betting, these are very sharp numbers. These are sort of like efficient markets. And just like it's hard to outsmart the stock market, it's really difficult to outsmart the bookmaker.
I know nothing about this. I'm going to be very clear. So I'm going to ask some really stupid questions.
Sure.
Who sets the odds on whatever it may be? I mean, whether it's the outcome of the Super Bowl or whether it's whether the quarterback will or the coach will say we'll go for the extra, we'll run a play on the fourth down instead of kicking. Who sets the odds on that?
It's a two-part question, and this is also a common misunderstanding. So people envision some guy with a frumpy, you know, polo shirt in the back of a Nevada casino scratching out numbers on, you know, Seahawks -4 or whatever for each game. Mm-hmm. Not the case. Yeah, there are bookmakers, and I don't want to discredit what they do, but really this is a reflection of global gambling activity. So they'll actually look at, you know, what are the odds like in Asia? What are they like in Latin America, in Europe, places with really robust betting markets, even on U.S. sports? And oftentimes what we're seeing in the U.S. is just a reflection of that. It's kind of a distillation of the world's conventional wisdom on sports.
But does somebody just pick a number? The odds are 20 to 1? 12 to 1, 15 to 1? And how does that happen?
It might start that way, and yeah, it's a bit of an art and a science.
Okay.
But really what it is they're seeing betting activity come in, and they quickly adjust their numbers based on that, especially so-called sharp gamblers, these professionals who spend a lot of time trying to get things right. When a bookie sees what the professionals are betting, they're going to move the odds accordingly. So that's why it's so hard for an average Joe to outsmart these odds.
So in the introduction to your book, you tell a story of Carson Barnett, who played for Purdue, and the story is about what happened when his last-minute end-of-game three-point shot pushed Purdue to a victory over Grambling State by 1 point. It ruined the game for Grambling State, but also for the people who had bets placed on that game. So take us through that.
It's a heartbreaking story, honestly. And it's also such a reflection of modern times. This was not happening to the degree that Carson Barrett experienced after the opening game of the 2024 college men's tournament. So he's a walk-on player. He injured his right knee severely at the beginning of the season, but he said, I'm so dedicated to this team, I'm going to postpone surgery, continue practicing, cheering my team on from the bench. And I don't really expect to play, but I want to be a good teammate. Right. Purdue is the number one seed entering March Madness that year. They handily defeat Grambling State in the opening round. They're up so much that the bench is empty and all these, you know, reserves get a couple minutes of playing time, including Carson Barrett. In one of the last shots of the game with like 35 seconds left, the ball swings to Carson. He's a sharp-shooting three-pointer, even though he's got a brace on his knee. Swishes a three-pointer. It's just his second basket of the season. You can tell his teammates are overjoyed. They're so happy for him. You know, he's been such a good guy for them. Back in the locker room, like so many athletes do nowadays, he's thumbing through social media to see, you know, what are people saying about me. And his night takes a really dark turn because everyone in his direct messages is just roasting him, crushing him, because his basket seemed irrelevant, right? Purdue was up more than 20 points. It turns out the spread on that game was 27 points. So if you bet on Purdue to cover the spread, they needed to win by at least 27. And if you bet on Grambling State against the spread, they needed to either win or lose by less than 27. And as a result of that three-point basket he made, Purdue won by more than 27. So it was really bad news for people who had bet on Grambling State against the spread. Yeah. They didn't think Purdue would cover, as gamblers put it. And the things he was getting in his direct messages were just grotesque.
Yeah, you print them. We can't say some of these things on the radio. They are grotesque, and it's reminiscent of all the conversations that are going on around the country politically on both sides. We've lost our way, and this is illustrative of that. We have to take a break. I want to come back and follow up on that, because this has led to other things that are even worse than that. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Danny Funt. He is a journalist and the author of a brand-new book just out called Everybody Loses, The Tumultuous Rise of American Sports Gambling. May not be the first book about this, but it is the most robust book about this. And we just talked about Carson Barnett, who played for Purdue and made that last-minute 3-point shot, which took them over the top and ruined bets for lots of people who had bet on the spread that didn't turn out to be accurate. So he was the recipient of a lot of vitriol from people who were who lost money and they were angry at him, which tells you where this is going. It's not about the game. It's not about being a fan. It's about you made me lose my money. Well, now we have instances of athletes working with, in some cases, these bettors to shave points off the game or to help them achieve whatever bet they have bet on during the game. Can that be controlled? Or are we in a new world now?
That's a mess in its own right. And let me just, to put a button on the Carson Barrett story, there was an official at the NCAA who is responsible for gambling policy. And as he put it, that sort of athlete harassment from gamblers was like a flickering flame before 2018, and now it's like a wildfire burning out of control.
Jeez.
So that'll scare you. These prop bets create such a fertile ground for corruption. You know, it's one thing to influence who's going to win or lose, or even
who's... And define prop bets before we go
Yes,
on.
Sir. So it's short for proposition, and the idea is that rather than just taking bets on the winner and loser of a game or the total point score, let's take bets on will a quarterback throw two touchdowns, will a running back rush for 50 yards, even things as obscure as who will be the first person to catch a pass in a football game, or there's live bets that you can do. So at the top of the sixth inning of a baseball game, will the first batter reach base or make out? Everything you can imagine material for prop bets now. And if you think about it, gosh, it's so much easier to say, yeah, I'll be sure that in the first quarter I don't grab three rebounds if that's a prop on my rebound total, compared to I'll make sure my team loses. It's so subtle at the professional or even the collegiate level. It's so easy for an athlete to influence something like that and no one would bat an eye.
But we've now had arrests of coaches and athletes for doing exactly that. How difficult is it to trace that and charge people with that?
We have. Just a week before my book came out, more than two dozen college men's basketball players were accused of fixing games in collusion with gamblers. And the people I've been speaking with from my book said things like that are an inevitability now.
Why is that illegal? And it's wrong. It's morally wrong, and it's not good for the sport. But why is it illegal?
Well, it's a federal crime to fix the outcome of a sporting event.
Really?
It's been that way since the 1950s. Once they realized that the mob got a lot of its money off of fixing athletic contests, the Congress and the Kennedy administration eventually said, not going to allow that.
For years, America's professional leagues, all of them, I think, were adamantly opposed to legalizing sports gambling. They called it evil, in fact. And now they've changed their tune. So why were they against it? Let's start there.
They had a century of evidence that it was bad for their games. For one, since the Black Sox scandal, basically every decade featured a gambling scandal of an athlete taking bribes to change how they played, to alter the outcome of a game. It clearly changes the way fans engage with sports. They didn't like the idea that you're watching, biting your fingernails, hoping, the spread is covered versus your favorite team wins or loses. And they realized that it's addictive and that it can be ruinous for certain fans, and they didn't feel comfortable pushing that risk on people.
So the gambling industry, knowing that revenue comes from most of these big sports from television, commissioned studies from Nielsen, and they are the TV ratings company that showed how rabid gamblers not only watch sports that they consume, it takes the ratings up because they've got money riding on the game. Is money the root cause of pro sports changing attitudes? Because if people are watching the game because they have money on it, and that causes the ratings to rise, their revenues increase.
Bingo. That's what I found. So even when the leagues and the NCAA were fighting in federal court to preserve that federal ban on bookmaking, they were meeting privately with representatives of the gambling industry. This was roughly a decade ago. And learning that their most precious asset, TV rights, as you said, it's not ticket sales, certainly not merchandise. The right to show professional and college games is the biggest moneymaker in sports. And they saw their audience aging. They saw young people not wanting to sit through a full game. And the fact that Nielsen was able to document just how rabid gamblers are at consuming all sorts of sports that normal fans don't really care about, that was very persuasive for the leagues. Nielsen also studied projections of how much money they would make from legalization. And the NFL is one example that sticks in my mind, because when you added up the direct revenue from these partnerships, you know, with sponsors, and the indirect revenue from making your audience hyper-engaged in that way, the NFL stood to make more than $2 billion every year from legalizing gambling. And that was just too good to pass up.
So sports betting, legal or not, has been going on since the beginning of time. People have been betting on everything. When it was illegal, bookies were taking these bets in the shadows. Mafia was certainly involved in all of that. Are they involved in these apps, by the way?
No.
Okay.
No.
Now that it's out in the open, it's on a phone near you. Not only is it no longer illicit to bet, it is encouraged that you do so. And this all changed in 2018. Prior to that, you went to a bookie or you went to Las Vegas. Now, because of a Supreme Court case, Murphy v. NCAA, they ruled that the federal law that blocked states from authorizing sports betting was unconstitutional. That result has brought in these apps. It's all about states? That's what it was? It was legal in Nevada. It was legal in some states where what they had Indian casinos or Native American casinos. But now all states wanted in on the deal because Murphy was the governor of New Jersey.
That's right. And the Indian casinos were not taking sports bets. They were prohibited from that. I just want to quickly amend something I said. The mafia is not running these apps. They definitely are fixing games. And in the indictments, there were some shady mob characters behind getting athletes to influence their play. No, this is regulated at the state level. By the way, when that Supreme Court decision came down, the justices were very clear to say Congress does have the authority to restrict bookmaking, and they could even grandfather Nevada as they had, but said the rest of you states are prohibited from doing this. The law had just gone about doing that in an odd way that was unconstitutional. But nevertheless, that was an opening for several dozen states to race, including North Carolina, of course, to race to legalize. And now there's some question of, did states do an adequate job of setting up, you know, proper regulations? Yeah. And does Congress need to step in?
The former governor, the Murphy in that case, Murphy versus NCAA, was former New Jersey governor Philip Murphy. Was his interest in this because Atlantic City had already become a gambling mecca?
Yeah, and the footnote to that court case is that the man who really brought the case was his predecessor, Chris Christie, the Republican. And I spoke with Governor Christie for my book. It kills him that his crowning achievement is called Murphy v. NCAA. He joked, there should really be a statue of me outside of, you know, MetLife Stadium where the Giants and Jets play, because, yeah, he doesn't like that Phil Murphy gets all the credit.
So the Supreme Court decision overturned an act called the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, the purpose of which was to stop the spread of state-authorized sports gaming and preserve the integrity of professional and college sports. So I was going to ask you if that law worked, but the better question is, how have things changed since the law was overturned?
The law worked somewhat, and another person I was honored to speak with was Theodore Olson, who was one of the greatest Supreme Court lawyers of his era and was hired by Governor Christie to represent New Jersey in that case. And I asked him, why in your argument to the justices did you bring up that there was a lot of illegal betting going on? Because that really had nothing to do with the constitutional question. Mm-hmm. And he said the justices rule based on the Constitution, but they also want to believe they're doing the right thing, you know, as a byproduct of those rulings. And if I was able to persuade them that there was all this illegal betting going on in spite of that 1992 law you just referenced, that would be persuasive. So the law worked, you know, mixed results. But again, like what we're seeing now is nothing, you know, compared to the peripheral gambling that was going on before that Supreme Court decision.
Danny Funt's our guest. This book is called Everybody Loses. It's about sports gambling, and you describe what happens when sports betting became legal as, quote, a plane someone is trying to build and fly at the same time. You've kind of alluded to this already in this conversation, that when these states quickly jumped in to take advantage of the legalization of sports gambling, they didn't really have a plan. They didn't necessarily build out the mechanics of how this would work. Are there no rules and regulations in place for this prior to the start?
There certainly are, but regulating online sports betting is so different from regulating a lottery or casino activity.
Why? It's
a whole different product, and the ways that customers can be taken advantage of in that format is so unique compared to other forms of gambling. I'll give you one quick example. There's an issue all over the country where sports books are offering so many bets now that sometimes they'll make a mistake in the odds they offer, and a savvy bettor will pick up on that and try to win a lot of money by seeing, hey, these odds don't make sense. I'm gonna hit them. And when that happens, the sports books try to void those bets after the fact and say, that was what they call an obvious error. We're not going to pay you. And in many states, they don't really have clear rules to govern that. And to bettors, it feels totally unfair. You know, part of the game is identifying odds that are inaccurate.
What's in it for the states? Just the tax revenue they get off your winnings?
Often as simple as that, yeah.
Because I know nothing about the state education lottery. Well, I know very little about the education lottery. I do know that it doesn't put a lot of money into education. But the Powerball is part of that. And the Powerball is a national lottery situation. And these apps are national apps. And you can bet on anything internationally and certainly nationally. So the states are only getting the money off your winnings. How do they know? Are they trusting these companies to tell them, I won $50,000?
No. So there's federal taxes, but as far as states are concerned, uh-huh. most of their taxes involve the revenue that these sports books are getting. And that is something they have to report. So if you were to win $100, you'd have to win more than that, but you'd pay income tax on that. That's a piece of it. But the much bigger moneymaker for states is the revenue that these operators are collecting.
As you point out, there were other parts of the world in which sports betting is rampant. It's been going on for years. The UK, South America, Europe, all have this tradition of sports gambling. So they have rules and regulations. They've had them in place, one would presume. Why didn't we just copy theirs?
It's such a signature element of American hubris, I guess, to be willfully oblivious to the rest of the world. I've spoken with researchers and scholars in the U.S. and abroad, and they pull their hair out at how frustrated they are that so many states didn't even take a moment to say what's been learned elsewhere, what regulations worked and failed, what research is there about gambling prevalence and problem gambling that we could go to school on when we're crafting our laws. It was a rush job. And even worse than that, they were often just fulfilling the model legislation that the sports books had written. I asked one industry lobbyist in Virginia about her experience persuading the Virginia legislature to pass the bill that the industry was pushing for. And I remember asking, so I get that this was a big success story for you and your firm and your clients. What was one thing that you didn't get that you were pushing for? And she thought for a minute and said, nothing comes to mind. We got everything we wanted. That was true in a lot of states.
You've talked to a lot of people in the course of doing research for this book, among them Bob Costas, the legendary sports broadcaster, who told you that betting has made sports more transactional than emotional. That sounds benign, but is it? I mean, our love affair with sports is an emotional connection to the team or the player on that team that we love, etc. If that goes away, can a banking transaction, which is what this is, replace that? Or are we just becoming a nation of avaricious money grubbers?
You know, it is important. I didn't spend the majority of the time in the book examining that question, I thought the way that people are being preyed upon and taken advantage of was a bigger story worth reporting. But you can't help but wonder if Costas is onto something. The commissioners used to warn about this. You know, if you go to a game and your team wins, but you're bitter because your bet lost, is that really what we want? I used to hear from people with legitimate gambling problems that they found that they couldn't enjoy a game unless they had a bet that they were sweating, you know, skin in the game, as they call it. Now I hear that from all sorts of ordinary people, that it just doesn't do it for them anymore to watch a game for the game's sake. They need to have a financial interest. And that's a profound change. And I wonder, you know, what that means down the road for sports. I think one of the reasons commissioners resisted gambling for so long is because they took the long view of generational fandom. And if that's how people engage with sports, where it's just, you know, who's making or losing me money is all they care about, that's quite a change.
And this is happening not just in sports. We have these lotteries all over the country now. And you, in the course of doing this, I don't think you gamble, but you did for this book, because you had to know how it works, right?
Yeah. I'll cop to that. So I used to, just like everyone else, I saw these ads. I saw the new customer promotions.
Right.
I was living in New York when they legalized, and you could pocket thousands of dollars just by signing up. So what was I to do? Yeah. Of course I did that. But now, you know, between hearing how hard it is to actually win and hearing the way that the industry preys on people, I've definitely backed off a lot in the last year.
But you did it in the course of doing research for this book, and you admit that you, quote, appreciate the thrill of putting down a wager to liven up an otherwise boring night. But sometimes the following day, you say, I feel kind of gross. But betting is everywhere. Mega Millions, Powerball, Education Lottery, now sports. I have 20 seconds. How did that transition occur? It's everywhere.
Yeah, boy, that's a whole other book. But I'll just say, when I said I feel gross, a third of gamblers say they feel the same. They feel ashamed about how much they lose.
Well, shame. Let's come back to that, because nobody has shame about anything anymore. And we're losing it when it comes to gambling, too. We'll come back to that. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sports gambling, the rise of it. Danny Funt is a local author, although he's written for major publications all over the country. He happens to live in Charlotte now, and he's written a book about this called Everybody Loses, The Tumultuous Rise of American Sports Gambling. And you brought up the word shame. I'm going to bring up some other words: addiction, corruption, corrosion. In your conversation with Bob Costas, he talked about his father, who evidently illegally bet on sports, and that sometimes the fate of the mortgage was at stake. And he called it exhilarating and traumatizing. When sports gambling was on the fringes, not as many people were exposed to it, not as many people participated in it. But for some who did, it became an addiction. So now that it's mainstream, has that addiction spread?
It seems that way. And because I live here, naturally, I spoke with a lot of people in North Carolina about what they're seeing. A professor at East Carolina University suspects that traditionally the expectation was that about 1% of the population is susceptible to a gambling problem. Now that professor thinks it's closer to 6 or 8%. Half of the calls to North Carolina's problem gambling hotline are coming from parents who are so concerned by what they're seeing in their kids, who are suddenly obsessed with finding ways to gamble. It's especially dangerous for young people, whether they're as young as elementary school, according to a woman who develops curriculum for North Carolina students. The idea that an elementary school kid has a gambling problem was unthinkable just a few years ago.
Well, it's interesting because this was predicted. This was made legal in 2018, but there was a congressional hearing. I think the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing in 1991, at which leaders of major sports leagues said that legalized gambling, rather than driving out illegal versions, more likely would have the opposite effect. And they claimed it grooms a younger, broader audience to take up the activity, and many of them eventually will be drawn to the black market. We can talk about the addictive nature of this in a second, but has that proven to be the case? Are they spreading their bets around beyond FanDuel into bookies and things like that?
No question. Again, the idea, you know, think about the argument that this would drive out the black market. What you're seeing is in states that haven't legalized sports betting, I think South Carolina is still in that position. They've yet to authorize bookmaking. Mm-hmm. They're seeing all the same ads that we are. You know, they turn on a game, all they're seeing is, you know, here's how great gambling is. People in those states are saying, where can I bet? Sometimes they Google, you know, sportsbook, and if you can believe this, Google, some of the first results are for illegal gambling operators. So in that respect, the black market is benefiting from all this legalized sports betting.
You also spoke to a colleague, a former NBA commissioner, David Stern, who was very opposed to sports gambling. He said he thought it was corrupting and corrosive. And one of his colleagues told you that he thought it would lead to, quote, addiction, street crime would grow around it, and, of course, the mafia would be in the middle of it, and that fans would be rooting for the point spread instead of the games. Has it happened?
Absolutely. I mean, maybe this stuff was just so predictable, but a lot of what they warned was spot on. I remember talking to a man who's in recovery for a gambling problem, and he went to a playoff basketball game. And these guys sitting in front of him, this was in Philadelphia, and those guys had come from Long Island, so they took, you know, a ferry to a train to a bus to a Uber to get to the game. And it's not cheap to go to a playoff NBA game either. And this guy told me all they were talking about at the game was, is a certain player going to get a steal? Because that was what they'd bet on. That's what they were there to see. And he just said, gosh, how sad is that? And that's not unique. The other thing from those hearings that stood out to me was the commissioner of baseball at the time, a man named Faye Vincent, who spoke with me for the book, was asked, would Major League Baseball ever get in business with gambling? And he said, that would make a mockery of my office. And now Major League Baseball is one of gambling's biggest proponents.
Wow. You talked a little bit about shame, and it's after you place a bet, sometimes the next day you personally feel gross about it, and I guess that's related to shame. But shame is in short supply in America these days, but perhaps not so short that it's been completely erased even when it comes to these companies that run these things, because I think you point out that employees for those companies are encouraged not to use the word gambling and instead are told to use the word gaming. Euphemisms are not necessary when you're proud of something.
Yeah.
So is this an illustration of that, or is this simply a marketing term that makes it more palatable?
Both, but it is telling that the industry won't call gambling what it is. This dates back to the 90s when the founding president of the American Gaming Association decided that was a good name for the industry's main trade group because gambling evoked not just a casino, but people, you know, losing their wives, losing their jobs, their lives being ruined. Gaming sounded innocent and harmless, and he thought, yeah, that's great. Maybe today it even evokes video games. But I remember there was a senator who demanded that the operators explain their partnerships with universities because a lot of people don't like the idea of targeting college students to sign up for gambling apps. And DraftKings wrote a letter that I got to read that made dozens of references to gaming. You know, here's what we're doing about gaming and problem gaming and whatever. Not one reference to gambling. Inside a lot of these companies, they still call gambling the G word. That's how verboten it is.
Wow. Sports, at least in America, sports has always had this element of all-American innocence. A lot of kids grew up learning their values from sports. I mean, sportsmanship is a value. What happens when you corrupt that by having athletes and coaches who bet on games, who then begin to do things to the benefit of people who have placed bets? Can sports maintain this patina of purity and innocence and American values when gambling enters the picture, even if there is no cheating involved?
I'm concerned, you know, no. That was what Senator Bill Bradley raised when he was pushing for that federal ban, you know, New York Knicks and Princeton University basketball legend saying He didn't like the idea of athletes being turned into roulette chips, mm-hmm. as he put it. I interviewed Matt Doherty, who lives in Davidson, the former head coach of the University of North Carolina men's basketball team. He also said, you know, the idea that sports, you would lose sight of these ideals that draw us to the game in the first place. I don't know. I mean, cynicism is pervasive in society in all sorts of realms. But the idea that we're seeing that at such a massive scale in sports is problematic.
We just seem to be destroying our institutions piece by piece, gnawing away at them, corroding. Corrosiveness is the word. We're mm-hmm. corroding all of our institutions, from religion to the Fourth Estate to the government to sports. What's left?
Gosh, I don't know. Classical music?
Oh, we'll find a way.
Yeah.
No. Listen up, WDAV. We're on you.
Yeah. I'm a listener. I don't know. But, the point is the die has not been cast, if that's the phrase. There's a lot that could be done to rein this in. There are so many consumer protections on the table that people are pushing for. This might sound hopeless, like, you know, game over for sports. That's not what I'm finding, and that's okay. Not what a lot of advocates are saying.
But if you do turn these players into poker chips, as Bill Bradley said, if you're betting on every aspect of a game so that you're not watching the game for the game's sake, it's just because you have money riding on something. We're turning these players into the cherries on a slot machine, essentially. What's left? Why be attracted to this sport? How can you tell a young kid, male or female, that you should that sports is where you get your values from? And if they don't get them from there, where?
I hear you. You know, early when I started covering this, someone asked me, could you envision a world where a parent wouldn't let their kid watch a sporting event because they didn't want them being bombarded with all these gambling ads?
Right.
At the time, I thought that was far-fetched. Now I'm not so sure because what we're seeing with youth problem gambling. I also think when we were talking about the TV audience, it seems quite short-sighted to use this technique, this trick to get people so obsessively watching sports. But will they burn out? That question is weighing on the minds even of people in the gambling business, saying, are we beating people to a pulp to such a degree that this is unsustainable?
Let's talk about demographics, because it is aimed at young people, and it's young people, particularly young males, evidently, who take advantage of this the most. Mostly young males under 35. You agree with that?
Yeah.
In North Carolina, the North Carolina State Lottery Commission says the dominant age of sports bettors is 18 to 34, 69% of whom are male. And they say that sports bettors in the state often go from no harm bettors to severe risk bettors in under 1 year, which is much faster than many other forms of gambling. Do you agree with that?
I do. You know, there's this idea that problem gambling is a progressive disorder, meaning if you use certain drugs, you can know pretty quickly if you have a problem with gambling. It can take a while. Sometimes you have to have a big win, and then you spend every day chasing that win, and that's very dangerous.
Why are young men attracted to this? Because they're more attracted to sports, perhaps, than young women, or because young men take more risks than young women?
I think that's it. From what I've heard, psychologists believe women gamble for escapism primarily. Men do it for the adrenaline rush, the risk-seeking component, and sports definitely activates that feeling.
I want to come back to something you were talking about earlier that we kind of brushed over, because Chapter 5 in your book is called Winners Not Welcome, and you tell the story of Bo Wagner, who won $50,000. You said the betting app DraftKings retweeted his win with this quote, Bo knows betting. They were bragging. This guy won $50,000 from us. You can too. The very next day, they cut him off. They limited his account. What does that contradiction show us about how these sites view not only their customers, but their own legitimacy?
Well, this comes as such a shock to people because so much of the advertising suggests sports betting is a real way to make money. If you know sports, you know what you're doing. This guy, Bo, didn't break any rules. All he did was say, I think a guy's going to be the top scorer in a basketball game, and I think these odds are a little off the number. And he bet and won, and DraftKings seemed to say exactly as you did, this could be you. This is the sort of person we want to publicize. The next day, he was barely able to bet a few dollars. You know, there was a FanDuel billboard in Charlotte that I used to drive by daily practically that said, turns out watching football can really pay off. And those words pay off were underlined just to ram home the point that, you know, if you know football, you bet on FanDuel, you could really win money. It's not the case. Maybe 1% of customers come out ahead. And if you do win or even just show that you know the types of bets that could give you a real shot at winning, they'll cut you down to pennies. It's ruthless.
This is like insurance companies. You make a claim, they cancel your policy.
Just about, yeah.
So is that what they do? Is that widespread or is that the exception to the rule? Do you have to really win a lot of money for them to do that?
That's the business model. And you don't even have to be winning money. I've seen people losing, but they were placing bets that the sportsbook, they're very good at this stuff. And they said, long term, those types of bets might give you a shot at actually coming out ahead. We're going to cut you down. And that's within their right. There's no state that says you can't do that sort of limiting.
So they cap you if you win. They cut you off. What happens if you're losing? Do they cut you off for that?
Not remotely. Those people, the sky's the limit on how much you can lose. There's no sort of over-serving principle in gambling. And I've seen some brutal instances of that. The other piece of it, and I don't know how much time we have to get into it, is they'll egg you on with some of the most phenomenal perks you could think of. Yeah. I've heard of these so-called VIP customers, people who are losing at minimum tens of thousands of dollars a week, getting to throw out the first pitch at a Major League Baseball game, have their kid take batting practice on the field, give the starting command at a NASCAR race, you know, drivers start your engine. All of it. It's like the dream experiences for a sports fan, as long as you're a massive loser.
You alluded to this, that it's cutting people off is one thing, but refusing to pay them when they win is another. And that you have several examples of that. How widespread is that? That they just say, well, I'm not going to pay it.
It's pretty rare. One person estimated it might happen like once a day nationwide. But it's more the what it symbolizes. It just goes to show how unfair a fight customers have, which was the argument for legalization was people deserve, part of gambling is, you know, no loaded dice and marked cards. And yet we're kind of seeing a version of that with sports betting.
Your book is called Everybody Loses, and you quote a DraftKings employee as saying that at the end of the day, these companies are built on losers. Is that a pejorative statement or merely an economic reality?
I think it's a confession. Another DraftKings employee said, irresponsible betting is what we're encouraging. So,
wow.
This was a main reason I wrote the book, is to hear from people who actually work in the industry. How do they think about their customers? And I think it should set off alarm bells because they are concerned.
So, knowing what you know from doing the research and writing this book, what do you believe should actually change?
I think it's totally reasonable for states and even Congress to consider stepping in because one thing's for certain, the sportsbooks have proved that they're not able to self-police. They say, "Don't worry, we got this. We can make sure our customers are safe." They have not lived up to that promise.
Can we do this, or is the horse already out of the barn, the genie out of the bottle?
No, there's definitely. I mean, you know, think about kids who haven't even come of age to start betting. Like, there's definitely time to weigh in.
Danny Funt, our guest this hour. His book is called Everybody Loses, The Tumultuous Rise of American Sports Gambling. If you're a bettor, it should give you pause. Thank you.
Thanks very much. My pleasure.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.